Now, in Archive on 4, Toby Amies digs into the collections of crate diggers and vinyl junkies who find the new in the old by collecting, dealing and making money out of second-hand records in Beat Mining with the Vinyl Hoover.
Yeah, he, the court is now in session. His Honor, Judge Pigmeat Martin Poseidon. The coat of swing is just about ready to do that thing. I don't want no tears, I don't want no lies. Above all, I don't want no alibis. This judge is hip, and that ain't all. He'll give you time if you're big or small. Fall in line with this coat is neat. Peace, brother.
Whoa, here come the judge. Here come the judge. Everybody know that he's the judge.
I'd been on the lookout for Here Comes the Judge by Pigmeat Markham, what some people reckon is the first rap record, for about 5 years before I finally found a copy in Moon Cursor Records near the Bronx. I'd been beat mining for a while by then, by which I mean hunting for records with good bits in them, little drum breaks, vocal or instrumental passages that I really liked. But why buy records for only pieces of them? Because of all my ex-girlfriend's ex-boyfriends, the only one I felt threatened by was the one who'd made her a mixtape that contained purely what he thought were the best bits of about 300 records. He'd really put in the hours and mined his collection to present to her the best of what he had. For the last 30 years, an international community of amateur archivists, passionate enthusiasts, and professional record buyers have been digging through our leftover music, cutting it up, re-releasing, or refashioning it, using the best sections to create new genres and to reinvigorate pop music. I wanted to know, really, what was the point in getting dusty fingers and building up a huge pile of nearly obsolete black plastic?
Religious people get all worked up and it's interesting to listen to them.
After spending about 1,000 hours and around £12,000 on collecting records, I've realised I'm just an amateur. Steve Stein, or Steinsky, on the other hand, is a true professional. He's been gleaning odd bits out of old records since the 1970s. He cuts them up for his collage-based music. His first instinct is to look for spoken word records. Where's the comedy? Where are the instructional records? The religious records.
Ooh, this one's a killer rapture record. This one's the best. It's called Flight, F-I-N-A-L, and it's about the rapture.
I will meet you in the morning.
I've got this one.
Oh, man, look at this thing. It's a news media documentary of the day Christ returns and the mark of the beast. And the entire record is done as a faux newscast on the day when half the population of the earth vanishes.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Paul Evangel speaking to you from the terminal of life near the gate of death, where along with many others, we will shortly be boarding the Interworld Airlines flight, F-I-N-A-L, for the New Jerusalem. This is the very first time that anyone in broadcasting has been...
When people get worked up and start talking about stuff, that's magic.
There is something magical about the process of acquiring and transforming all this music and speech. So magical, as you'll hear, it's worth changing or risking your life for. Anyone who watches the Antiques Roadshow can imagine the possibility of something old and rare being worth a lot of money, purely, of course, for insurance purposes. But what sent Steinsky into the archives is not greed, but curiosity and a kind of captivation with the oddities of the past. But he wasn't the first to nick bits from other people's records.
We are not going to interrupt this record.
Yes, we are.
I remember hearing The Flying Saucers by Buchanan and Goodman, and I heard it on a jukebox in a Chinese restaurant that my mother used to take me to when I was about six.
The Flying Saucers are real.
These guys had written a lunatic comedy script about a flying saucer landing in Times Square.
We switch you now to our on-the-spot reporter downtown.
Come on, baby, let's go downtown.
Take it away, John Cameron Cameron.
This is John Cameron Cameron downtown.
And it was some hyper-voiced announcer like this, like that. And he would run around asking questions of bystanders. Their answers would be hooks of popular records at the time.
Pardon me, madam. Would you tell our audience what would you do if the saucer were to land?
Duck in the air!
Thank you. And now the thin gentleman there.
What I'm gonna do...
It's called a break-in record.
It's hard to tell.
The gentleman with the guitar. What would you do, sir?
I'm gonna take a walk down the street.
Thank you. We return you now.
I remember hearing it and going, wow, what? This sounds crazy.
We interrupt this record to bring you a special bulletin. The reports of a flying saucer hovering over the city have been confirmed.
That's how a 1950s novelty hit became one of the foundations of hip-hop. Buchanan and Goodman were using sampling and collage techniques pioneered by avant-garde classical composers like Stockhausen and Xenakis. This music concrete had become possible with tape recording, and the situationist philosopher Guy Debord provided the term détournement to describe the process of subverting a culture by appropriating and quoting parts of it in opposition to its original intent. Hip-hop, the music and culture that surrounds rap, also appropriated the idea of play so central to music concrete. It marked the point where cut-ups like Buchanan and Goodman's entered the musical mainstream and ceased to be a novelty, changing the way pop music was made and listened to forever.
Rapping, scratching, breaking, shaking, the success of hip-hop is in the making. On TV and on radio, you hear and see it wherever you go.
Guy Debord and the Situationists were a great influence on Sex Pistols manager Malcolm McLaren when he was involved in the manufacture and marketing of punk rock in the 1970s. But the détournement he experienced in the early 1980s at a party in the South Bronx was homegrown and way more influential on how music sounds now than any punk rock.
I couldn't believe it. I was very, very worried being the only white guy there, and the cab driver gave me the signature that I should put my dollars in my socks. Nevertheless, I escorted myself across the road with this guy and made my way through the crowd, pushing and shoving, until I got to the decks where the music was coming from. Shook hands with this huge fat guy, who later became known to me as a guy called Africa Bambaataa. And what I witnessed was a various group of different young kids who were popping in and out amongst the decks, messing about with records. Now, as far as I could see, it was extraordinary because the sound coming out was totally inarticulate. It was a load of rough noises, noises that sounded a little like a guitar, but had a sort of like a concrete chisel sound, right? And the sound, I realised, was actually coming from the way they were messing around with their hands on the decks, moving records backwards and forwards. But they weren't just doing it with one record, they were doing it with two, and they were mixing across one to the other. In fact, it was making music out of other people's music.
I remember going to the Roxy when Bambaataa was playing, and he would have crates and crates and crates and crates and crates behind him and Jazzy J, or behind him and Red Alert, or whoever he was playing with. And I remember the records in the front of the crates would be essentially signals to collectors in the audience, like, check out what I got. And one of the records he had was an original pressing of one of the Mardi Gras Indians records from New Orleans, which I had, but did not realize that anybody else knew anything about. And here's Bambaataa showing this off in the front of his crate at the Roxy. And I was thinking to myself, well, he knows about that too, huh? Son of a bitch.
Of course, musicians have always been influenced by what they listen to, but hip-hop came directly from record collections. When Bambaataa or Grandmaster Flash took to the stage, they did so with the world's best musicians at their fingertips. They were great DJs, but to be that, they also had to be great record collectors. And to be both, they had to stay ahead of the pack and find their music when no one else was looking.
I had dreams that I found records at the record stores, that I'm looking through the crates, and I found like four or five of a record. Oh, wow. I had dreams I found records.
They call him the 45 King. His mum knows him as Mark James, a hip-hop legend responsible for the backbeat behind some huge hits and legendarily nimble of finger when poking through stacks of wax. I asked him to explain the complicated process by which DJs create hip-hop.
We find an old record and we put drums under it, basically.
Thanks, we'll be off.
Even though it can be that simple, this process changed pop music permanently and changed how we listened to it. Previously, music from past generations was relegated to oldies stations and stations for oldies, where it might turn up as a novelty. Hip-hop's explicit quoting of the past means that now, yesterday is woven tightly into today. The search for the perfect beat can take you all over the world, but it starts at home.
The first thing you do is you look at your mother's records and what records she had and your father's records, and I think that's the start. Don't put them back in the right covers and stuff like that. We're looking for a drum track, a bare drum, like drums with no bass line and, you know, just the drum part.
The break.
The break. Mm.
The biggest record I've had in history, the 900 number by the 45 King, came because I couldn't afford to take an artist into the studio at that time.
This is the 900 number, and that was Aaron Fuchs, owner of Tough City Records. He's earned himself a reputation as both far-sighted businessman and formidable record collector. He understands the value of vinyl very well and has used it as a currency.
If you were an old man, you'd got a bottle of liquor. So I said, well, these are young men and they're DJs. Let me hit them off with some rare records. And that also extended to getting producers to work with me for less than they normally would.
He had a bunch of 45s. Take these and see what you can do with these. And I seen what I could do with them.
Unwind yourself. I'm on a turn that's cool. Come on, baby.
I gave him a copy of Unwind Yourself by Marva Whitney. The whole point of DJ production and DJing was to be able to use something that existed as a blueprint for your own original construction.
I can tell you, the posse is taking charge of the 45, can't kick in the B.O., the posse is large. I'm telling you, we real large in the place, 88, play the unit with my man DJ C. Justice and the 45 King, yeah, peace.
If you are going to sample records, then you are going to find your drum sounds, your melodic pieces, your bass lines and things are going to come from existing records. And the construction of a beat using those pieces, when people say, oh yeah, he's a producer and he makes beats, this is what this guy is doing.
And this is where the idea of digging in crates for records is a bit like mining for gold.
Yes, very much so. That collage aspect of using existing records and changing the context, it really affected the way people heard how to make records and how to use sound.
Digging around in our own crates at the BBC, we found a collage of a collage where Matt Black and Jonathan Moore, aka Cold Cut, do a kind of director's commentary of their remix of Eric B. and Rakim's Paid in Full. It shows the enthusiasm, knowledge, and sometimes avarice inherent in anyone who's greedy for beats.
This is a journey into sound.
Yeah, that was a phrase off a stereo sort of test record, Introduction to the World of Stereo Sound, and I got that in Camden one afternoon. I was just looking through the bins. I thought, I wonder if this has got anything on.
This is a journey into sound.
Got it home, stuck it on the decks, and that phrase came on.
A journey which along the way will bring to you new...
That other thing, that do-do-do-do-do, that's the salsa orchestra from...
Love Break.
Love Break, that's it. Of course, the beat is Ashley's Roach clip.
Ready? I throw this switch. Pump up the volume, pump up the volume.
The Ashley's Roach clip is more widely known as the Soul to Soul beat. And
it's Chuck Brown and the Soul Search.
It's Chuck Brown and the Soul Search is Ashley's Roach clip. And he was used on Milli Vanilli's record Girl You Know It's True, and we use it on Paid in Full. But enough respect to Chuck Brown's drummer. His name's lost in the mist of black music history, but it must be there somewhere.
This calls Ofra Hazza there, rocking away in the background. That's from Now Imane Alu.
That was amazing because we put it on and it was the wrong speed and it was out of tune. Then we just slowed it right down, and it came out exactly the right speed to go over it, and the tuning was just right. Sometimes things just happen like that, in tune with the bass line and everything. It's amazing.
There's congas in there from Boogie Woogie, bright, aren't there?
Yeah, sound experience.
Sound Boogie experience, Woogie. Yeah.
There's another good break. There's the other good break, which no one knows, which is... Shall we let it off? Yeah, we could do it.
Yeah, they'll never find
Radio
it.
Radio 1. It's Bang on a Drum off a Play School record. It's
BBC.
Seriously good. Yeah, BBC record, man. It's the drummer gets seriously funky at the end for about two bars, so he looped up part of that. That's got to be one of the most obscure breaks out, I reckon.
Quite a lot of the phrases were off tape. Tapes off the radio. That when...
When all is ready,
I throw this switch. That was off the radio. Some of them are Mikey Dread. Well, no, Mikey Dread. So I start my mission, leave my
residence, thinking how could I get some dead presidents. I need. It's a funny mixture, this record, really, because like the original version on the LP was like, it was a great groove with the serious break and the Dennis Edwards bass line, but it wasn't quite there, you know. And we thought, well, we can make this into something really good. But I mean, it's funny that original groove. The Dennis Edwards bass line is still massive. The break is massive, massive. You know, that with funky drummer has got to be the most popular break of the last couple of years, really.
It took us 36 hours to do this, didn't it? Put together in the studio at Banner Island Records.
It's a marathon. A pen and a paper, a stereo, a taper. Me and Eric being a nice big plate of this, which is my favorite dish. But without no money, it's still a wish. Cause I don't like to dream about getting paid. So I dig into the books of the rhymes that I made. Soon as a test to see if I got pulled, hit the studio, cause I'm paid in full. Dodgy, dodgy.
We spent hours trying to get out that bit, but that was it.
Sometimes you just get hung up on something, you know, but in the end, you know, as George Michael used to say, the kids will never know. You know?
No, just cover that up with a bit of echo.
Just pile the echo on.
That one, two, three,
That's JB.
There he is. Mr. Brown.
And that's Hassan 711, Emotions Can Be Serious, dub mix.
By George, even London grooves.
Pump up the volume, pump up the volume.
Pump that bass. Pump that bass, public. Original concept, not public.
That's weird with original concept, because that their record, Can You Feel It, blew us away when we first heard it. And we started trying to do something a bit like that. That was even before Beats and Pieces, wasn't it? And then Beats and Pieces, we used some little tricks from it. Not actual samples, but some of the ideas, like the stab echoing away, like, And then like a year later, they sample that, and they sample Greedy Beat, another of our tunes, and it comes back over here.
It's Charlie
weird,
Says.
It goes round.
Charlie Says, wasn't it?
That Charlie was Says, that's right.
Peach Boy Laugh.
Bernard Fowler.
Yo, you go to your girl's house and I go to mine, because my girl is definitely mad because it took us too long to do this album. Yo, I hear what you're saying, so let's just pump the music up and count our money. Yo, but check this out. Yo, Eli, turn the bass down and just let the beat keep on rocking. And we out of here.
This stuff is really fresh.
This is DJ Sel from Bass Incorporated on the decks. He's a young scratcher we got in, a session scratcher. We had to turn the mixer upside down, didn't we? Because there's a weird way of doing it.
This is Fab Five Freddy, so everybody knows this. Oh, this stuff is really fresh.
Not everyone knows still where it's from, you know?
No, it's on the B side of
Change le Beat.
It's the one.
Pump up the volume, pump up the volume.
Wait a minute, you better talk to my mother.
That's a gangster record.
Okay, okay, all right.
It
That's
was
Robert
them.
Regan. Okay, all right. I take
that Flexi.
Yeah. Oh no, it's off that Flex, isn't it? Yeah. It came free with, was it Raw or one of those weird magazines? Yeah. Good old Ronald.
Okay. All right. All right.
Yo, what happened to Pete? Yo, what happened to Pete?
Pete.
another James Brown tune.
Hot Pants. What's horror? It's
so,
free expression.
Yeah, chill out. You can really hear those congas from the boogie woogie break now. It's a good break, that actually.
It's so fresh.
Steinsky.
The night camps.
This is the play school one. You can just hear it dying away.
Cold cut in full effect. In a dance record, the beats provide the narrative, the music, the characters. It's a culture that exists on and off the record, reverential and self-referential, quoting and celebrating itself, recycling as much as it discovers new material. Together with his partner Double D, Steinsky demonstrated this in his aptly titled Lessons.
A lot of the surprising left-hand turns that came in our records came from, in my case, the fact that I had grown up listening to every record I could take out of the library, which included show tunes, spoken word, all manner of anything that was on vinyl. And I think in Lesson 3 we use a song from the Pajama Game called Hernando's Hideaway.
I know a dark, deep-rooted place, a place where no one knows your face, a glass of wine, a fast embrace. It's called Hernando's Hideaway.
And that came from the fact that I liked that record when I was a kid. And the fact that you could easily put it over a beat because it was just these spooky voices and a castanet. And now there are kids listening to that who, they don't know the Pajama Game from a hole in the ground, but, you know, they know that little verse that we used. And I think that, you know, yeah, that's kind of nice.
Beat mining is intensely personal. After all, the records you buy and use signify your identity. But it's also a business. And there are bounty hunters out there.
Check it out right about now. It's no other than Funk Soul Brother, the Lord Finesse. And you're welcome to the world of the Vinyl Dogs right about now. So if you're digging, peep how we do it like this.
There used to be the Vinyl Dogs. They knew where all the stashes of records were. And they would lead producers to these places and get paid for that service. Warehouses, guys with basements, used to own a store, has all the stock in a garage. They would either take you on digging expeditions to places that they knew about, or if you did not want to go out for the day, they would play you a break over the telephone. They would play you 10 or 15 breaks. You would tell them which ones you wanted, and you would pay them, and they would deliver them. Here's the record. You know, the break's on cut 4.
Law Finesse is out to make pace, down with the crew for digging in the crates.
When hip-hop DJs started to expand their search for the freshest and rarest records to fuel their turntables, two worlds collided and continue to feed off each other.
Crate digging begins with the stuff that hip-hop DJs like, you know, the genres you cover.
Aaron Fuchs understands that dance music is special among genres, both because of its acute link with its past, but also because of the fierce turnover of product that needs to serve the dance floor as much as it does the marketplace.
It must have been circa the early 70s. I mean, I would sniff speed and go to warehouses to just, you know, and then just look for records for, like, you know, 18 hours straight. And you'd always see the little cracked records on the floor. You knew the doo-wop collectors had been there first. Sweet as an Angel by the Jivin' Juniors on Astness. It was lying there cracked on the floor of Raymar Records. I knew the doo-wop guys were there before me, but genres keep acquiring kind of collectability, so I got there for the musics that came afterwards. And I would see the want lists of British collectors, and by respecting that, I understood that there was this gap between what was good and what had become successful.
Before hip-hop went crate digging, music fans in the north of England had invented their own genre, centred around obscure, forgotten, mainly American recordings that came to be known as Northern Soul, often discovered years after their original pressing. It was a genre built around records, heard out of context, and perhaps loved all the more for it.
It's so hard to find a girl.
This is mostly all the old Wiggany stuff. I have suddenly taken this giant love of Northern Soul again.
Keb Darche is legendary as a collector and transatlantic funk evangelist, but his first love was Northern Soul. In fact, he briefly dealt amphetamines to fund his purchases in a small market that was so hot, it forced some extreme record collecting in America.
They've got a ghetto, they've got records. And it was a case of, you get the phone book and you'd go through and you'd phone them up, you've got 45s, you've got old 45s, you've got any old soul 45s. Yeah, we got soul 45s, down you come. A lot of them are like, what the hell you want all this nigger music for, boy? You gotta go see Bob Contagno, he buys all that crap. Okay, I'll go see him, you've got his number. So I'd go there and start digging through there for rare records. And then, can I go through the back, please? And that's when I started to, digging through cardboard boxes, cockroaches crawling up your arm and all that. And, oh, that's wonderful. Hooray, 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 I'll buy that.
Could I encourage you to take the cigarette out of your mouth and tell us some of the labels that are going past here?
OK. Backbeat. Where's Backbeat from? That's Texas. Smash, New York label. Peritone. That was Oscar Perry's own label. Oscar Perry on Peritone. Failed miserably.
You learn, you know. Any redneck, any schmuck, could put out a black music record because it offered him the greatest chance of return on his investment because it was the most bedrock of record purchasing communities.
What does that say? I need my glasses for
international
that.
International artists.
International
straight
artists.
Straight out of Austin, Texas.
You learn so much why there's certain rarities on every label. There was always the guy hanging around the studio that the label owners, it was more useful for them to get the coffee than to become a star, like Curly Moore over at Seasane, or the guy who just wouldn't tour. You know, Eldridge Holmes would never tour beyond Louisiana and Texas.
Crate diggers develop an acute skill set that's not only dependent on their ears, but also on an understanding of the culture surrounding the music they're looking for. They're continuously sorting and resorting the vast, unorganized archive of popular recordings out there. Increasingly, we assume if it's not in the digital domain, it doesn't exist. Beat miners discover and preserve what progress overlooks.
If you found labels like that, which look pretty cheap and nasty, or this, which looks really cheap and nasty, you thought, that's going to be great, because it's not had some big nyaffy producer jumping in there and, you know, fancying it up for the radio. It's just raw.
This stuff isn't done by people who are Harvard Business School graduates. I always used to wonder why there were so many great records on Rick and Ron out of New Orleans, and I'd never heard them. And you find out that he was a guy who was cautious. He knew he had Texas and Louisiana, and he was satisfied to get his sure thing income there.
Yeah, there we go. That's probably the rarest record in there.
This one here, what's that then?
Greater Experience, Don't Forget to Remember, on a label called Colony 13. That's probably about 700 quid, something like that. Just...
Baby, don't forget to remember that I love you so. Love you so. I need some hat.
I won't buy anything over the £500 mark now. It's like, no, that's too silly.
That's very reasonable of you.
You see these teeth? That was one record. That's like £7,000 worth of dental work. I gave the guy a record. He was a record collector in Manchester. Dave the Dentist. And he wanted me mellow madness off me, and I'm like, you're a dentist, aren't you? Because I used to take a bit of gear, as we know. And he had a look at my teeth and said, oh my God, that's about £7,000 worth there. Deal done.
If the speed cost Keb his teeth, vinyl nearly cost him his life.
Please remember me.
I was shot at twice. I had an old woman stick a shotgun in my face. I used to deal with her husband. He was a record dealer and he'd send me stuff. I found out that he died in Edna Minor. That was it, Edna Minor, richer than Edna Minor. She was left with her son and all the records and didn't really know what to do with them. I thought, right, I'm off to Miami. And I gets there and the phone's up Edna Minor. Oh, I'm in Miami. Can I come and look at the records? I'm really sorry to hear about your husband. Can I come and look at the records, please? And like a vulture. And she's there, her son's lying on the couch with a bottle of whiskey on the floor. I'm like, okay, son, you want to buy them records? Yes, please. Off she goes to the kitchen, comes out, shotgun, boom, you try and steal them records out, well, you balls out, boy, we got dogs. So, okay, I go upstairs and I'm there for 2 days ploughing through the stuff. At one point, I went down for a shit in the toilet. She came with me. Back to the house with my little box. The son's woken up, he's on the sofa. Okay, son, how much do you want to pay for these records? $1 each. I ain't working my penny off for no dollar each. And he storms into the kitchen, out with the shotgun again. The son stands up, smack, knocks her out. His own mother. I'm sorry, sir. I hope my mother hasn't given you a bad impression of our estate. $1 each for these, but that one's got to be $5. I know you people want that one. Okay, thanks very much. Out the door.
So why would someone risk their life or go so far as to pay £7,000 for a record? Because of how it makes them feel. That's the privilege of the collector or the DJ, being the curator of these objects that have the power to make you feel good. For some, that comes simply from ownership, the black vinyl full stop at the end of a long hunt. For others, it's the symbolism, the glow that comes from being connected to a culture and history that's inherent in an artifact. But for the beat miner, who's no stranger to the first two sensations, it feels especially good because of where it can take you. Steinsky again.
Before the idea of sampling and making beats from records, when it was simply record collecting, then it was, oh, this is interesting, I wonder what this sounds like, or this could be good, or this is the last record in the series, the one I didn't have, thank goodness, or this is very rare and it's priced wrong, so I'm definitely going to buy it and sell it to someone else. There was the strictly mercantile imperative for buying and selling records and crate digging. But now that it has become, this may have a drum fill that will be really fantastic, or this may have a piano intro that I can chop up and move around as a really great little background for a rapper, well, then that makes it even that much more interesting.
Unlike Northern Soul or doo-wop, the resurgence of interest in funk records is not so much to do with their value to music collectors, but to music makers. The rise in interest and value in disco's earthier brother sparked a series of reissues and a Rare Groove revival in the UK.
I thought, hip-hop's all based around funk, so I'm going to push this funk stuff more than anything because it'll get folk into good music in a roundabout way, which was my plan. And then it went very big.
Keb Darj had a dilemma. He wanted to sell the music he loved, but he'd learned from his days on the Northern Soul scene that a DJ has to protect his best records. So he indulged in some archival camouflage and made use of a practically obsolete recording medium that nicely prevented him from selling the real thing, the vinyl, to the competition. He put them on cassette.
I used to sell the cassettes, but I made up all the names on the cassettes. I used to use American Civil War generals' names for all the singers. Because I was studying American Civil War history at the time and I knew loads of names that sounded American and would have fitted as though that could have been a black, George Washington could have been a black singer. Nathan Bedford Forrest sounds like, whoa, that's some obscure black artist. But it wasn't, it was just some hillbilly hick from the South. And then one day this yank comes along and he's flicking through and he's listening. Nathan Bedford Forrest? I've got this by Leon Gardner. Yeah, and that one's Arthur Mundy. That's not James Longstreet, that's Arthur Mundy. So he was a serious digger.
A digger known more by reputation than sight.
Guess who's coming? Guess who's coming? Guess who's coming?
Someone walked into my studio and went, hey, you know about this guy, DJ Shadow? I said, no, who's DJ Shadow? Oh, he made this record, he name checks you on the inside. I'll be damned. Who's this guy?
From listening to records, I just knew what to do. I mainly taught myself. And, you know, I did pretty well, except there were a few mistakes I have just recently cleared up.
DJ Shadow, or Josh Davis to his mum, brought the beat mining underground to the surface with his album Introducing, an original work composed entirely of samples. Shadow and other collector DJs like Cut Chemist were dubbed turntablists as they used record decks in their live performances and recordings, proving how the collecting and playing of records can be an art form and a way of making a living.
I was at the airport with Shadow and his wife, and Cut Chemist got in the car And there was, of course, a few, you know, pleasant moments of, hi, how are you, what's going on, blah, 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 blah. And then there was a moment of silence. And then Chemist turned to Shadow and he went, hey, you know that guy in Ireland that had the five Blue Label 7-inches that we were looking for? Well, I finally got the money. I bought them from him, and I traded two of them to that guy in Germany for the LP that I was looking for. And Shadow went, oh, yeah, well, you know that guy in Phoenix who's got the store in his basement that's only open on weekends because he works in Dallas? I got in touch with that guy, and we're going to be working something out. And it's like, all of a sudden, I realized, wow, these guys are so far into it. What was a hobby for me is a living for them. They know all of these guys. Vinyl Dogs, hell yeah, we know Vinyl Dogs. You know, there's three guys in Korea who will go leading you around into Korean basements.
But to find one of the world's biggest Vinyl Dogs, I didn't have to go to Korea, but to a converted barn in East Sussex. Harold Moores has sold secondhand vinyl to both Hitchcock's composer Bernard Herrmann and Jarvis Cocker. For over 30 years, he's made a living out of hearing the difference between how much something costs to him and how much it's worth to someone else.
Most of the secondhand records, if not all of them, before the mid-70s, were sold below the price of new records, simply that they were secondhand, therefore not of the same value as a new recording. Well, I believe I helped change that approach. I had already begun to feel that secondhand LPs, you shouldn't necessarily put them out cheaper than new if they were intrinsically interesting. The industry, of course, was only, what, about 25 years old at that point, so it needed the perspective of time for that to start sinking in. And I set out on a search, which has never stopped, really, to find new and exciting and profound things. One of the most interesting phenomena is the growth in value of recordings where the Japanese market has taken an interest. Often women violinists from the 1940s and 50s that they seem so transfixed by. I mean, the violinist Johanna Marzi, who had a short recording career, they fetch surprisingly high prices.
And with so many options available to the collector, perhaps it's inevitable that some people will build up a fetish around one particular genre or artist.
Some record collectors, they actually get into the artist because he had, you know, you had a drum break at the beginning of your record, Now We Love You. Yeah, come on.
Now, I'm not in love with Idris Muhammad, but I was very excited to meet him at home in upstate New York.
This is Poughkeepsie, I'm a car star.
Partly because of his drum breaks, but more for his drum style, tight but human, full of soul and New Orleans.
Nobody could play the funk like me. Max Roach says to me, he says, listen, Idris, your style of drumming should be canned and sold in a supermarket.
And it almost has been. Idris is one of the world's most sampled drummers and effectively invented a lot of the basic hip-hop rhythms 15 years before the genre existed. Long before they got their hands on him, his contemporaries knew he had something, if not where it came from.
When I was a young kid, I used to hear this bass drums, boom, 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 boom. So every time I heard that, I was outside, and I used to dance under the bass drum player. And the guy would say, hey, get away from under there, man, I hit you with this matter. Get out, go on the side. That contributed to who I am today. I played from the bottom up, the bass drum up. All guys play the top down. That's my style. My first hit record I made in New York was Lou Donaldson's Alligator Boogaloo. And the rhythm that I played on that, every drummer in New York City wanted to know how that was done.
And how was that done?
That's easy. It's me.
You know why I do that? Everything I play gonna be funky.
What is a funk drummer? What's the root of funk?
Funk drummer is something that you could play that felt so good you would get up and dance as soon as you hear it. Yeah, baby. That's it. Play that record again. That's what funk is. And that's what I had. That's what I did.
The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. But not hip hop, yo. Boom, but you got on. Boom, but you got on.
When did you become aware that people were sampling your beats?
Long time ago. My son helped me to it. He says, "Hey, Dad." I said, "What?" He said, "You know, so-and-so took some rhythm off of one of your records." He said, "Man, Dad, that's a big hit." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Who is he, so-and-so?" I said, "Yeah, that's all right, son." He said, "Well, Dad, you ought to try to do something to prevent this." I said, "Well, you see, what happens is that at the time that I was recording, there wasn't no sampling. There wasn't nothing like that. You can't get a lawyer and say, hey, man, this is my rhythm. I did it at this time, and then this guy's got it, and this is..." So I said, "Well, son, if I ponder on this, then I'll make myself sick."
Surely every artist who's felt the spotlight move away from their corner of the stage wants to be rediscovered. But even though you might hear yourself drumming on some records you never even knew got made, doesn't mean you're going to get P-A-I-D, paid.
I play the way I want to play, not the way the hip-hop take one loop and they make a whole song out of that loop. I don't play like that. Now, Lou Donaldson just, he told me this. Somebody sampled a rhythm from one of his songs. They made a hit. They sold 500,000 units. And they sent Lou a big check from Blue Note Records because he wrote the song.
But the thing that got sampled wasn't Lou Donaldson.
Not his melody. It was the drum rhythm. Hey, man, look. I told Lou several times about this. Hey, if you don't want to share, great. Take the money. Mine's is coming. Be happy with the money. But remember who did this. So, they got to live with it. I'm kind of, you know, I like where I'm at in this kind of thing. They don't pay you. They don't give you some money. So much to them. Use the money, man. I'm cool. I ain't begging. But when you see me, you want to go hide in the bathroom. Because you can't face me.
You used to dig for drums. Now you have to dig for stuff to put on top of your drums. Where every sounds, the bass line, the beat, and the blah, 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 and the hook sometimes, to hide the holes in the drums. If you use an old record to put over the holes, you won't hear the holes.
So then what happens?
You can sell a beat, hopefully. You want to buy a beat? Everybody's talking about you. You should be able to sell your tracks. If not, it's going to be a hobby.
If it's not a hobby, it can be pretty lucrative. Jay-Z's Hard Knock Life sold over 8 million units. Mark found the hook.
This is the record I used with record for Jay-Z.
It's a hard knock life for us.
I bought it for 25 cents at the Salvation Army.
Get a treat at
in Hackensack.
Get a kiss at.
I was looking for the horns.
Take the bass line out.
And what I found was the kids singing, "It's a hard knock life for us."
It's a hard knock.
And so I used that. After I sold it to Jay-Z, I found the horns. Kicker Pre played the acetate copy of what I did, and Jay-Z heard it, and he liked it.
This is the part of the process I find fascinating. How do you work out how much you can get paid for an idea?
Everybody has a different deal. If you can get $1 million, there you go, that's the price. When you sell a beat, that's just an advance. Mm. You get a stand of 3 points. I made the most money off a stand.
Now, that's the Eminem song that sold over 2 million copies, and points are a percentage of every record sold. Chas Hodges was happy, and is still happy, with the £60 flat fee he got for playing on another Eminem track, My Name Is, when he was a session musician in the 70s. Incidentally, Chas is the Chas that goes with Dave, as in Chas and Dave.
It was my son who came up and he said, there's a record out that you're playing on, Eminem. I hadn't heard of him. And he said he's got a worldwide hit. And that, your riff, is the major part of it. And he played it to me, and I could just about remember it.
Now, given the opportunity to document a seminal piece of pop history, I had to ask him what he could remember about the session where this legendary sample was first created for the album Remember My Song by Labby Siffre.
The first thing that comes to mind, Derek Lawrence wanted to call his album A Dose of the Siffre, but I don't know if he was joking or not.
For the record, Derek Lawrence was one of the producers. Chaz was on guitar and a bit of piano. Dave was playing bass. Ian Wallace was on the drums. I want to make this clear. Eminem's biggest hit is backed up by Chaz and Dave. Rockne is hip-hop.
The full credit for that should have been Jim Sullivan, who was the arranger. I was just carrying out what he said. He played as Chaz. And I think we needed one more track. It was done pretty quick that I got there. It was like the end of the session, and Labby couldn't think of anything to call it. Instead of I got the
blues.
Ran out
of words halfway through.
Yeah. Said, I got the,
By its eclectic nature, beat mining forces a broad perspective in the monomaniacs in search of the raw material and inspires an open-minded love of all genres in the listener.
Once a piece of music gets pressed up, it can become detached from its original cultural circumstances and make it to groups of people which they weren't intended for, but take on a complete life of their own.
Like this, Bird's Lament from Merlin Lookalike Moondog, which Mr. Scruff bought in a second-hand record shop and turned into Get a Move On, his biggest hit to date. Early in his career, he was referred to as the Vinyl Hoover, and he's picked clean every charity shop in the north of England.
The thing that hones your kind of hunting skills for vinyl is doing it on a budget when you're young. Getting stuck into a Salvation Army shop in somewhere like Hazel Grove, where I used to live, a little suburb of Stockport, you can never tell what you're going to get in there. Anytime anything came in, the charity shops would ring me up and said, right, you know, Peter's bought something in, you might like this, or, you know, oh, we've got 4,000 records up our shopping point, and we'll get our Jack to take you down there. And it was amazing being the only person who was into that, you know, the kind of soul music and jazz music and stuff like that. You can buy a lot of crap records just so you learn not to buy them again. You know, I now know when I look for the James Last section that, you know, Russian Dance Party isn't a particularly good album.
If we had, say, 1,000 here, I'd be running my eyes along looking at the spines, for the most part, occasionally pulling out one that didn't have a clear spine, just to check. What have we got here? a 10-inch of Tom Lehrer.
Harold Moores knows the score. Unsurprisingly, he was the heart of the much-loved classical record shop, Harold Moores, in Soho, catering to a community who pursue their loves, passions and obsessions with as much enthusiasm and monomania as any crate digger. In a proper record shop, you can begin to fully understand the physical appeal of a quality medium that still delivers the intangible.
People would come down the stairs into the basement and there would be a sort of intake. You could hear it quite often as they were taking in this sort of very distinct aroma of old paper and cardboard and I'm not sure about the vinyl itself, but certainly it's part of the romance, as it were, of the LP.
Let's have a look.
Gentleman, musician, journalist and committed collector, Bob Stanley of the band St Etienne, understands the peculiar mentality of the vinyl enthusiast slash purist from the inside and out.
The type of collector you get now compared to 30 years ago is quite different. It's people just looking for breaks, or just people who are collecting for the sake of collecting, which I find myself doing now.
You find yourself collecting for the sake of collecting?
Yeah, it's not that I really need the music on original vinyl. I'd prefer it that way. That's my favourite format. But I don't need it. Well, I'd like to have a collection.
I think people need to collect something. No matter what, you'll find that if you look in people's houses, they're all collecting something. I mean, I think it's a very human trait to have.
B. George once had way too many records at home, so he gave them away to a charitable foundation, which he had just created.
A lot of the collecting is, A, to be special, to be interesting. I mean, I think that's a part of it, too. People have to have something to make you date them. Well, I mean, that's part of the beauty of all this, is that people are crazy, right? I mean, you only really want to meet the really crazy ones.
I remember going into what was then Plastic Passion on Blenheim Crescent and buying a single by Paper Blitz Tissue for 70 quid, which I'd only had on cassette for years. It had never been reissued. And feeling like really nauseous that I was spending all this money on one single and feeling it was sort of wrong. But of course, it's a slippery slope.
This is quite an organised collection we're sitting in here, it seems to me.
This is my second bedroom, in theory. I mean, I moved house. The flat I live in now, it's a concrete building with underfloor heating, so there's no radiators, which gives me more wall space. And also the weight of the records, which is considerable, it's not going to go through the ceiling into the downstairs flat, which was a problem I had where I lived before. I was in a Victorian conversion, and the ceiling started bowing slightly with the weight of the records.
Is it like an addiction on occasion?
Yeah, it's exactly like an addiction.
To the point where it is an addiction.
Our largest collection came from someone whose house was sinking from the weight of the sound recordings.
B. George created the Archive of Contemporary Music in New York's Tribeca to act as an ark for two of every record they could get their hands on. Today, it houses over 2 million items.
You walked into the house, the oven was gas, the oven door was open, there are records stored in the oven, and the pilot light is still on. There's always the story that all your stuff fell on you and then the dogs ate you, you know, because you were alone in the apartment or the house or whatever. And this was one of those kinds of houses. It was like negative space. There was a trough to his bed and everything else from that edges of that trough to the walls was sound recordings.
That he would never have time to listen.
Well, he had covered up his turntable about 5 years earlier, so he couldn't listen. You know, the whole house could have gone up, and it was sinking, and it was condemned, and so we took the materials. Unbelievable in the pile of newspapers, we found one of our rarest records, which is the first Rolling Stones recording signed by the whole band. But it had been low enough that his dog had peed there for about 10 years. So we've got a little, Keith Richards' signature is a little wavy because the dog had peed on this record.
Sometimes I remind my record collectors of not losing sight of why they're collecting it, why they're buying it. It's the music that they should be putting first. And when I sense that it's become something else, collecting record numbers, let's say a sequence, I usually have something to say.
I just want to hear the music, that's all.
Is it too complicated to just keep my records in the category, okay? Just put the rock and roll in with the rock and roll. Put the R&B in with the R&B.
That's eight, children.
I mean, you're not going to put Charlie Parker in with the rock and roll, would you?
What does it all mean?
I don't know. Who is Charlie Parker?
Yes!
I love records.
As much a curator as a collector, Johann Kugelberg is also passionate about his responsibilities. He sees the hoarding as a gateway to redemption.
My good friend John Savage taught me this. He said, the knowledge that you hoard has to be utilized for, sounds pompous, but has to be utilized for some sort of component of communal good. You have to use your knowledge for something. You know, you write articles, you DJ, you do a radio show, you do books.
Making money from writing about music makes it okay for me, I suppose. Being able to turn it into something I can make a living out of.
Whilst it's true that some people may not always make it to the turntable to play that incredibly rare Turkish psychedelic record, the point of beat mining is to feed back into popular culture what it's forgotten or ignored in its march forward. As drum machines were replacing drummers, samplers were adding the funk back in by directly quoting Idris Muhammad. From hip-hop, this culture has spread to dance and then pop music. The work of crate diggers has been responsible for reissues of lost music that has opened up the pleasures of rediscovery for the less committed record-buying public.
A lot of people I know have no interest in reissuing things at all, either because they're so obsessed with the original format or because they don't really like to share stuff and want to keep it for themselves. I think I've always sort of bought records to play to people and spread the word, I suppose.
You know, these people are all really, really passionate about their niche, and they are dragging whatever that niche is, kicking and screaming into the 21st century, is that regurgitation of the past. It is kind of a necessity in a West that is starting to approach its sunset of importance, how crap a metaphor that is.
If we are heading towards a cultural end time for the West, we can be thankful that B. George, the world's least discerning crate digger, is in charge of the Ark.
You have a belief that the music that people create is culturally important. It may be mistaken. It's really up to the next generation to decide. And we're always struck by things like that Bob Dylan never sold a million copies of anything until there was a CD release.
How do you value the vinyl in the collection?
Well, we don't. Our acquisition policy is pretty liberal and sloppy. We don't have the rarest of the rare. What we have, though, is a really complete overview of what happened. I just picked up at a flea market, you know, somebody reciting the winning numbers of the lottery. Okay? It's an entire disc of just someone going, 7, 27, 42.
I was a vinyl collector because that was the way of the world when I became interested in music. The idea of music just being so much more available to people is so fantastic. And now it's as simple as, you know, 15 seconds from now, you can have it.
What's great about electronics now is that the information is spread out in so many individual places. What's bad about it is you may not be able to play them back in the future. I mean, we say that, you know, with vinyl, we know it lasts 60 years. It may have a few scratches, but the sound is still there and it's embedded. We can't say that about electronics. I mean, I can take a bicycle wheel, a rubber band, a rusty nail, and I can play back my recordings.
But only once.
Even with the digitization of most music, unless you know to look for it, it's going to stay rare. I mean, rare would mean you know of it and you're looking for it. In this case, I'd say a lot of it is just completely unknown.
It's obvious that the eclecticism, inventiveness, and inclusiveness of crate digging informs a big part of today's pop music, still very much in hip-hop, but also in the more mainstream delights of Lily Allen or Britney Spears. But more importantly than that, it matters because the culture it created helps us understand the real worth of art in a time of unreliable values.
There are people going back to find these things that they can use for new purposes, and I'm all for that. Whether what brand of music it is, it doesn't matter. If they look back and can find inspiration, music will advance, to my ears anyway.
And those are some fancy ears you've got.